Support for Prairie Public is provided by Matt Fern, director of Fighting Over Sioux, a feature-length documentary about the University of North Dakota's controversial name and logo. Available on desktop, TV, and mobile devices and select theaters starting November 25th. More information at fightingoversioux.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. Today we'll start our show with Tessa Johnson. She is with the North Dakota Nurses Association, and she joins us to talk about the challenge facing her profession. Tessa, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your circumstance. Are you working remotely?
Yes, I am. I currently do have COVID-19, so I am working remotely. My day job is I am a executive director of a long-term care community in Dickinson.
And how are you faring?
Better. Yeah, the first couple of days were a little rough, but I think I'm out of the woods.
Okay, good for you. I'm glad to hear that. How would you characterize the challenges facing nurses today in North Dakota hospitals and care facilities?
Sure. It's very, very difficult. As everybody knows, our hospital capacity at this point is very, very high. And our nursing shortage is becoming more and more of an issue for several reasons. Nurses are exhausted. They're quitting the profession, which is terrifying because we already have a nursing shortage. On the other side of that, they are either a close contact, so they are quarantined at home, or they have contacted COVID-19 and they are quarantined at home for that reason too. Other nurses that are still working are exhausted, they're emotional, they're stressed out, they're to their breaking point.
Are members of your association contacting you about their concerns?
Yeah, absolutely. What we did early last week when the governor put out the executive order that it was permissible for asymptomatic COVID-positive 19 nurses or healthcare workers to return back to work, we immediately reached out to our association members as well as nurses across the state just to hear their feedback. We very much wanted to know what the pulse was on that decision, and I will tell you that it was not good. Our nurses really felt like that was kind of the last straw. They felt that they've been working multiple days in a row, long hours, overtime. They've put their family's needs, their children's needs aside so they can step up and take care of the patients in this crisis. But to think that now, even if they contract the disease, that they may possibly have to go to work, they were really upset by that and felt really like the rug was just kind of pulled out from under them.
Now, are these nurses that were involved in this decision asymptomatic cases of COVID, or would these be somebody like you who has COVID and recovers eventually and then goes back to work? Would these nurses have been asymptomatic cases of COVID? They tested positive but weren't showing any symptoms?
You know, I think either one, whether they were symptomatic or asymptomatic, nurses very loud and clearly stated if they contracted the virus that they very much wanted that rest and that much needed break.
Do you know how many nurses might have contracted COVID in the state? Has there been any kind of report?
You know, somebody asked me that this morning, and I don't have that data, but I certainly will get to figuring that out. I know that's definitely a question that people would like to know.
Are you aware of any deaths among people in your profession in the state?
Yep. As a matter of fact, I just heard late last evening that there was a nurse in a long-term care facility who was 56 years of age who had zero underlying conditions that did pass away from COVID-19.
Well, that seems to defy a lot of preconceived notions about who is most at risk and who can suffer the worst consequences and that kind of thing. You mentioned that there is evidence that hospitals are running out of space, and the concern is about staffing, not just space. How close are we to the edge here?
We're at the edge. I'm sure that the public has heard Sanford Health in Bismarck has opened Sanford Health Accessories building to open up more beds, which is great. We're happy that they have these plans and that this is happening. But again, the concern is staffing. How are we going to get staff for these? They Did find out yesterday, late evening or afternoon, that we did get it approved, the state did, to get the relief from the Army nurses. And so that will be great as well. We're excited to have them. It'll just be a matter of, you know, our entities getting them trained quickly so we can get them to the workforce.
Are North Dakota hospitals hiring these so-called traveling nurses? Is there a bidding war for them?
I would say there's a bidding war everywhere. Like I stated to begin with, I work in long-term care, and for months we've reached out to travel agencies for staff that we need, and not only nurses, but certified nursing assistants and dietary staff, and there's just nobody to be had. Even 6 months ago, we could reach out and we could find somebody to give us a short-term solution. At this point, there's just nobody. There's some travel nursing sites and blogs online where other travel nurses, you know, speak to each other about assignments that they're on. This is good, this is bad, this was exciting, and we've seen some pretty harsh comments from agency travel nursing that have came to North Dakota saying that basically in a nutshell that it's a mess and don't go there and your license will be at risk. And so that's really sad to hear, and it's worrisome.
So the state has a troublesome reputation beyond its borders for nursing?
That's what it's looking like, yes.
Are some North Dakota nurses that you found out about, are they opting to travel literally for more money? I mean, leave the state?
Yeah, I heard from actually a nursing faculty yesterday that she had spoke to some of her students, and they said, you know, we may take travel assignments, not students, I guess I should say recent grads, I'm sorry, that we're going to take some assignments outside of North Dakota just because they don't feel like the practice is safe here for them.
How are nurses chosen to work with COVID patients?
You know, I think at this point, everybody gets some sort of assignment to work with COVID patients. I don't know the exact algorithm or how that's worked out. What I do know is that people who work in multiple different departments of hospitals have been asked to work in COVID patients, whether they are an OBGYN nurse or some of them that work in the operating room. Some have reached out that said they work in education and they're being pulled to the floor. So I don't think anybody is immune. I think anybody and everybody that has some time and is willing will be put in that unit.
What about a nurse who has these so-called underlying conditions? Can you decline a job?
You know, I can't speak specifically to that. From what I've heard from nurses that are working in those hospitals, if you're told that you need to work in those units, that's just kind of the way it is. I haven't not heard specifically from any that have any underlying conditions, whether they've been told that they have to or not. So I can't answer that.
Is there any process typically in a hospital for sort of mediation about these issues, a discussion between the professionals?
I would say so. You know, I would say that to some degree, there should always be some professional courtesy. You know, I know in my own building, we have what I would call higher risk. I have some pregnant staff. And if we have to pick staff that are going to work with our COVID positive patients, those are not going to be our first staff that we're going to choose. So I would hope that colleagues would have each other's back, so to speak, in that sense.
The mask has been a very controversial issue in our state, nationwide for that matter. There is now a mask mandate in effect with some teeth involved in it. Does that give you some comfort? Is it too little, too late? What's your reaction to it?
We were very thankful that the governor stepped up and did that mask mandate. However, we do believe it was too late. We do believe that if we would have tried this mitigation strategy earlier, that we would have hopefully or possibly not been in these situation that we're in right now.
The numbers of positive tests coming back have been consistently well above 1,000 for quite a while now. And you mentioned hospitals are at capacity. What happens if a hospital can't accept a patient? What's the process? Do you contact people out of state? Is it possible that somebody with a severe case of COVID will die at home because there's no place for them to go?
The short answer is yes. I think that's what people need to understand, is that when they're out of beds, they're out of beds. I mean, you can't just make one appear overnight. So I have heard that, yes, that they've, I heard at one point, this was quite a while back already, I would say at least 6 weeks, that on the more western side of the state, they were shipping patients to Montana. I do think they're going to ship them out. I think eventually that we could get to that crisis where there's just nobody to help. And the other thing that I think people need to so seriously understand is that it is not just about COVID patients. Everybody that's ill needs a bed. And so you may have other ailments, whether it's blood pressure issues, heart attack, diabetes, motor vehicle accidents, just a simple broken bone from your child on the playground may need a hospital bed or a nurse, and they're maybe not available for those reasons either. It's not just about COVID-19.
You work in a long-term care facility. Those have been indicated since the start of the pandemic as particularly sensitive places. What precautions are in effect where you work?
Of course, everything that CDC and State Health Department mandated. The North Dakota Department of Health has a VP3, which is a Vulnerable Protection Program. And so that really sets the rules and the stage for what we do. For very, very short time during this 9 months have we have been able to allow family members and to visit our loved ones, which is awful for them. It's awful for our residents. It's awful for our staff to have to see that agony for our families. So visitation limitations is a huge thing. Also, a lot of PPE and a lot of screening. So we spend a lot of time screening our residents as well as our staff. And we spend a lot of time testing. The testing cycle in long-term care, I think it's great. It's definitely a sense of security to know who has COVID in our building so we can get them isolated in a timely manner and try to reduce that spread. But on the other side of that, it's very time consuming and it's very emotionally taxing on everybody involved. So for a long period of time, I would say at least 8 months, we were testing all residents and staff twice a week. And there's only two of us nurses in our building, and that's very staff intensive. The cycle of testing is very emotionally intensive. You plan the test, you administer the test, you anxiously await the results, which sometimes take up to 5 or 6 days. So by the time you get those results back, you've had somebody positive in your building for 5 days. So that's very frustrating. Then once you get those results, you have to isolate and redo the schedule if it's a staff member, and you have to retrain your staff on what you want to do and how we're going to do it and communicate that to families. And then you start all over again and you test the next day. So that whole process can be very, very intensive.
It does sound intensive. It also sounds like if you got to wait maybe 5 days, you could be infected the day after you took the test and be infecting people.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, last week we had we tested on a Tuesday and we didn't get results until some of them were on Sunday. And just as a perfect example, which this wouldn't have mattered when we got the results anyway, but we tested Tuesday. I got my result on a Sunday and then I did a rapid test that same day and it was positive. And so it's really a matter of testing at the right time and education and really educating people to stay home when you're ill. And that's why I did the rapid test, because I had a symptom and so I did it. But we also had a resident that came up positive in that 6 day wait period. And so that was very frustrating. We tested her on a Tuesday and we didn't get that result until Sunday. And so she was in our building around other residents and staff for those 6 days.
Have you lost residents due to this?
We have not. We have been lucky enough that up until this whole pandemic, we've only had two positive residents. One of those results I just got today. So we've had two during this whole time and probably about 7 staff.
It seems like, aside from the workload, that there's a fair amount of anxiety and perhaps overwork and among your long-term care patients, loneliness and other things that are part of getting well or feeling better about yourself. How would you gauge those aspects of healthcare?
For the residents or the staff?
Both.
You know, both of them is very difficult. My building specifically is a memory care unit, and so there's not a lot of silver linings to somebody who has the disease of dementia. But what I will tell you is that that is one of those silver linings. Our people generally see us as staff as their family because we're every day, and they may not realize that it's been 6 months since they've seen their spouse or their children. But their children and their spouses sure remember that. And so I think it's very difficult. Again, our family members are like family to us, and it's very difficult to see them emotional and stressed and crying on the other side of the window. It's very hard. I will also tell you that as staff members, we're going to carry grief for this for years to come. This is not something that we're going to just get over when this pandemic hopefully ceases. There's things that we have to do on a daily basis and tears that we shed and decisions that I have to make that I will have to live with for a long time. And they're very difficult. These things are very difficult on our mental health. They've taken tolls on our families, our children. It's very difficult to try to continue to help my child with online learning and to still continue to be a mom and a wife, you know, as well as a daughter and a lot of other roles that I play when you work 60 hours a week. because that's what we're going to do, because those people are vulnerable adults and they need us, and they need us now.
If you're a nurse in a hospital and you test positive and you have to be quarantined, you alluded to this, do you go home and then your whole family has to be quarantined, or can you be quarantined in the hospital?
For the most part, you do. I mean, they did say in the executive order that you could be quarantined at the hospital. I mean, but are you saying if you're symptomatic, could you stay in the hospital?
Yes.
Yeah, I would say if you're sick enough that you could stay in the hospital, yes. But I think, you know, the greater majority of the people that get it aren't sick enough to be in the hospital. So that does have you quarantined at home.
But isn't it possible that a nurse working at a busy hospital, we've got a hospital or two in Fargo with hundreds of beds each, a test positive, goes home, quarantines for 2 weeks, comes back to work, test positive again because of the environment she or he is in, goes home. At what point does the cycle become unbearable?
The cycle is unbearable. The cycle is unbearable now. But what I will tell you is that the recommendation from CDC is that if you test positive, you don't test again for 90 days. So it kind of gives you that 90 days of reprieve.
Wow.
Because you could still be shedding that virus. And that's why you would test positive, but not contagious. So that's the science or the recommendation.
That's a fair amount of time. That probably contributes to the shortage of staff.
Mm-hmm. And so, some of the long-term care facilities, they were in a very difficult situation for a while, but once all of their staff tested positive, then they don't get retested for a while. So you kind of are safe, you know, that they're going to be there. But then if that round starts again, it's still too soon to see the reinfection rate. Are people going to get reinfected? The studies are too soon to see what that looks like.
Have you heard the story about the president and CEO of Sanford Health?
I did.
Kelby Krabbenhoft was quoted in a report in the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead as saying that he has had COVID-19, he's recovered from it, and so he's not going to wear a mask because that would be a symbolic gesture because he considers himself immune from the virus. What's your take on that?
I think there's too much mixed data right now to tell us how long the immunity lasts from the natural infection. It's just not clear enough. There's some documentation that people have been reinfected within 3 to 4 months, or some as early as 45 days. So I think that that's a risky move. And I also think that that statement in itself is just very disheartening to all the healthcare workers and nurses that work in our state. I also have heard that in the public, one thing that's very frustrating is the constant changing of people's minds. You know, we're going to do this and then we're going to do that. Even I'll tell you, I know Governor Burgum was asked this question in his press conference. People are frustrated that you made a rule and then you changed it 3 days later. And, you know, he said that's just the way this is going to be with this virus. We're going to learn more and we're going to do more. But those kind of things are what cause the continuous contention and battle that we're fighting in the community. You know, so it just gives people one more thing to say, well, Mr. Krabbenhoft doesn't need to wear a mask, either do I. And you know, that's his choice and he has his beliefs, but also, it's just so difficult to continually battle those things. What we know is that masks do help. They do work. Are they going to completely eradicate COVID-19? We don't know. We know that there's a vaccine on the horizon. We know that there's other solutions that are coming, but what we do know is that it works. And so we should follow the science and we should do that.
Some sheriffs in North Dakota have said that they will not enforce the mask mandate because they think it's a personal right or privilege not to wear one. What's your message to them?
Again, I think it's a very reckless message for them. I understand the fact that law enforcement in our state is busy. They don't have time to write tickets and infractions for everybody not wearing a mask. But what we do ask is that they show support to their healthcare providers, that they speak out and say that they understand that COVID-19 is real and that it's a problem and that we need to all do our part. When they stand up and say they're not going to enforce it, that just gives people more run and room to say that they're not going to wear it. We just would ask that they support us, because when they say those statements that they're not going to enforce it is simply saying that they don't support us. And that's frustrating, because healthcare and law enforcement have had a very respectful, longstanding partnership, and we just want to continue that.
Well, we've been in this pandemic mode now for the better part of a year. As you mentioned, there is some very promising news about vaccines, new kinds of vaccines, messenger RNA vaccines that seem to be, at least in the early tests, remarkably effective. What's your take on how much longer somebody like you, a frontline healthcare worker, somebody who should be at near the top of the list for the first to get a vaccine, what's your feeling about your immediate future, or I should say over the next few months, whether or not you're going to be protected?
Yeah, from everything I hear, everyone keeps saying soon. My guess is that we're probably 6 weeks to 2 months out. That's just kind of what I keep hearing in continuous meetings that we're in. I do know that the state, Long-Term Care Association, we are all very, very much diligently working on a plan. As soon as it's out, we are ready to distribute that. Again, I think half the battle is going to be convincing people the importance of it. I think we just need to focus our energy on education and in getting that message out there that it's safe and the effects of the vaccine and that it can, again, save lives.
Well, the best of luck to you and your family. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Yes, thank you so much, Doug. Have a good day.
Tessa Johnson is with the North Dakota Nurses Association.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Prairie Public is here to help you in the 2020-21 school year. PBS Learning Media has thousands of curated, standards-aligned videos, interactives, lesson plans, and more, easily searchable by grade level and discipline. And it's all free. Find it at prairiepublic.org/education.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is a member of the Bannock Shoshone tribe and the editor of Indian Country Today. He also writes and voices commentaries about Native issues, and today he talks about the potential for historic inclusiveness in a Biden-Harris administration.
A new administration is an exciting time. There are so many possibilities. Some are obvious. Others, less so. There is a lot of speculation about Representative Deb Haaland being named Secretary of the Interior. She is Laguna Pueblo, and she would make history, because a Native American has never served in a presidential cabinet, except that is for Vice President Charles Curtis, but that's another story. Clearly, Haaland has a shot at that history. She is already involved with policy issues that the Interior Department faces as a member of the House Natural Resources Committee. In addition to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Interior Department also manages most of the public lands, some 70,000 employees, and nearly $12 billion a year. But the thing is, and this gets back to possibilities, there are so many possible combinations beyond that one agency. Let's say, for example, if her New Mexico colleague, Senator Martin Heinrich, was to get an appointment to the cabinet, then Haaland would be a natural to move up to that job. There are other similar opportunities in other states. Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota could take many jobs in the cabinet. Then, an ideal replacement would be the state's lieutenant governor, Peggy Flanagan, White Earth Ojibwe. There has never been a Native American woman in the United States Senate. The new administration must appoint some 4,000 jobs. There's actually a book for that. It's officially titled, As the Government's Policy and Supporting Positions. But most people know it as the Plum Book because of its cover. It's a list of jobs that are appointed by the president along with their salaries. Some jobs, such as Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, require Senate confirmation. But most are jobs that can be appointed without much fanfare, such as the Director of the American Indian Environmental Office at the Environmental Protection Agency. This time around, there is also the possibility of appointments to jobs in agencies across government, especially those that do not specifically deal with tribes. That could include appointments at the Department of Agriculture, Education, even the State Department. One way to think about this is by the numbers. Let's say American Indians and Alaska Natives are 2% of the population. Then parity would be about 80 appointed posts. We have never come close to that. And it's unlikely that this will happen this go around. But it's also likely to be progress toward that more inclusive, representative government. Perhaps the Plum Book should be renamed the Possibilities Book. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark and Native Issues online at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, a conversation about gratitude as we prepare for the Thanksgiving holiday. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The superintendent of the Valley City Public Schools says so far his district has not seen a shortage of substitute teachers. Other districts around the state are facing that problem. Josh Johnson says the district is preparing for that possibility. He says there is a three-step plan for that.
Each tier of that plan will have different increases within that, whether it's the increase of compensation or whether that is going to reach out and extend into individuals within our community who may not traditionally sub for us. At the highest level of consideration would be then for that we have reached out to our business partners within Valley City and created partnerships that will allow us to be able to license substitutes that are currently working in other businesses in an effort to keep our schools open.
Johnson says the plan has the support of the state licensing board. A fall survey of ag lenders shows the farm economy is still under stress, but most farmers can expect to get loans next year. The survey shows bankers are concerned about farm debt and the fact that many farmers will not make a profit this year. Jackson Takish is the chief economist at the Federal Agricultural Mortgage Corporation, or Farmer Mac. He says credit will still be available.
If you look at the expectations from ag lenders, even though they said they only expected about 51% of their customers to be profitable this year, they expect to approve 90% of all requests for funding in the next year.
The survey was taken in August. Since that time, crop prices have improved, and Takish says if prices stay above break-even, the outlook for the farm economy will improve next year. And Minot will be moving its city hall. The current city hall is close to the Souris River and has been affected by floods. Minot Mayor Sean Sitma says in 2005, the city applied to the National Disaster Resiliency Grant Program for funding to relocate City Hall. And the city council has chosen the old Wells Fargo Bank building in downtown Minot. Sitma says the purchase price for the building is $2.6 million. He says the project will cost around $10 million for remodeling. Sitma says moving City Hall downtown will also help the city's efforts to revitalize the area and the city's economy.
You know, as we go through and try to look at businesses to move to Minot for, expansion or completely relocating their facilities into the Magic City, if you're going to go into a city hall that is old and cramped and gives off the vibe that, that the community really isn't serious about itself and even taking care of its own public facilities, and not that the current city hall is in bad shape, but you walk in there and you kind of feel like a sardine.
Sitma says the city can't add on to the existing city hall because it's in the floodplain and it would lose more than $7 million from the resiliency grant program. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
A few months ago, economist Nicholas Bloom was taking an important work call in a spare bedroom. All of a sudden, he heard this sound.
It was two of my kids starting their daily practice on the bagpipes.
This week on Hidden Brain, the challenges and opportunities of working from home.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Matt Fern, director of Fighting Over Sioux, a feature-length documentary about the University of North Dakota's controversial name and logo. Available on desktop, TV, and mobile devices and select theaters starting November 25th. More information at fightingoversioux.com.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanksgiving in America has a number of traditions. There's the overladen table and time with family, maybe the Macy's parade and football on TV, followed by Black Friday shopping. This year, the traditions may be altered, but the reason for the day is worth considering. How did Thanksgiving come to be? In We Gather Together, journalist and author Denise Kiernan created a book about a subject timely for the holiday, gratitude. She visited with South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lori Walsh.
Welcome, Denise. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I want to start with Sarah Hale. This is a story about this writer and editor, and most people are surprisingly familiar with her work because she's the author of a very famous children's poem. Tell us a little bit about how you were introduced to her.
actually hard for me to remember when I first came across Sarah Giuseppe Hale's story. She's one of those people who the stories about her and her writing and her relationship to Thanksgiving are here and there. And I remember the first time I came across her, I think I was actually working on another book, and sometimes you just come across things, and I do what I always do, which is create a file, keep all these different idea files about different kinds of people and things that I find curious that I might want to write about down the road. As key a figure as she is in We Gather Together, I don't really write traditional biographies, so I knew I wanted sort of something else to come across before I decided to do something that Hale might figure into. I often find myself drawn to sort of the intersection or juxtaposition of events and characters as much or more so than the individual events and characters themselves. And her intersection with so many people throughout the 19th century who were then unknown writers up through presidents, I found incredibly compelling. So the more I began to look into her and come across more of those intersections, as well as her role in Thanksgiving, I became more convinced there might be something here. And then finally, I was just looking at the idea of gratitude as, you know, sort of a compelling human instinct, something that's been on this planet and has been a global concept, you know, as long as humans have been around. And to me, that was kind of the linchpin for We Gather Together, is in a way looking at the evolution, different aspects of American culture as seen through the lens of our relationship with giving thanks. And Hale is a central figure in that journey that we go on in the book.
As I read it, I was taken with the fact of how much this idea of a national day of Thanksgiving means to her. It's not a, I'm going to sell magazines and therefore I need to, you know, pursue this idea. She's deeply invested in this. Why do you think it was so important to her to continually come back to this idea of gratitude and Thanksgiving?
I like that you talk about that she wasn't sort of like she was doing this to sell magazines, because she was such an influential editor at the helm of what was one of the most, if not the most popular, magazine of the mid-19th century. And she used that pulpit to promote many things, Thanksgiving among them. But it was often used to not just to sell copies. It was to share passion projects and, you know, not just Thanksgiving, but also, you know, various charitable causes and unheard of writers she thought needed promoting, or traditions she thought should catch on, or ideas about education, which was so important to her throughout her life, promoting education, especially for young women. The Thanksgiving fascination, and I think fascination is kind of putting it mildly with in Hale's case, she was the daughter of a Revolutionary War veteran. Her father was injured fighting in the Revolutionary War. She grew up in a house where the Union and these very, very new United States of America was a very important concept in her childhood and how she was raised. She had lived to see every president, Washington through Hayes, when she died. So I think you take that kind of devotion to the concept of the Union and her ideas about wanting that union not to get torn apart, because, you know, the further you get into the 19th century, the worse things are looking for the United States and its ability to stay together as we start heading into the Civil War. So I think you take that love for the union and you sort of combine it with her family history and the fact that she grew up in New England, where Thanksgiving practices were around, and she clearly liked overladen table. Mm-hmm. And this was something that was very appealing to her. And I think those things combined into the idea that this holiday, we should have another national holiday. There were only two at the time, Washington's birthday and Independence Day. And what a unifying holiday that would be if everyone in the states and the territories and Americans abroad could come together on the same day every year and give thanks.
Speaking of that table, I'm going to read just a sentence or two from page 74, where she writes, "The roasted turkey took precedence on this occasion, being placed at the head of the table, and well did it become its lordly station, sending forth the rich odor of its savory stuffing and finely covered with the frost of the basting." And then there's beef, there's lamb, there's goose, there's...
Don't forget the goose and the ducklings. Yeah.
Keeps.
And believe me, I only put in a small part of what she put in that chapter.
Wow.
This was on and on and on. Current wines and pickles and you know, how the table was set. And it's hilarious.
It has to be one of the earliest examples of food writing, of culinary writing.
Oh, yeah. This is 1827.
Yeah.
She's writing this description. She called it, she said, the description of a feast is a literary treat. She says, you know, she serves up her style to novel epicures. It was really, I mean, this kind of description of that kind of feasting, and not just what was eaten, but the linens and the tableware and all of that sort of stuff. Incredibly indulgent and detailed, but you could actually see it coming out of the pages of Martha Stewart.
Yeah, Martha Stewart, MFK Fisher, eat your hearts out. Okay, so I want to talk about the presidents, because I found this really, really fascinating, and I'm guessing that you did too, with, you know, from George Washington to John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, these early founding fathers, two of them had very different approaches and some real hesitations about a national day of Thanksgiving.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Thanksgiving has been around for a very long time. The word has been around for a very long time, certainly long before the United States was around. Washington was the first president to proclaim a national day of Thanksgiving. And it was the last Thursday in November when he did it. And it was a pretty quiet day. Businesses were closed. He himself went to the jail and gave some money so there could be some extra food and ale for, you know, the people who were imprisoned there. Adams followed suit, but did not do it on the same, doing it on the same day just wasn't something that was a thing yet. He chose a different day, and his was fasting and humiliation. And days of fasting and humiliation, he was not the only one to ever declare those, but that was a very different sort of proclamation and message he was sending out. And one down the line in a letter he wrote to a fellow founder, Benjamin Rush, he thinks probably did him in, made him viewed as, you know, too stern. And then Jefferson, who was a big believer in the separation between church and state, recognized that days of Thanksgiving could be secular or religious in nature. You know, it might be a Thanksgiving proclaimed for a battle of victory, or a Thanksgiving proclaimed for, you know, a more religious reason. And those sort of conflated with harvest festivals. But Jefferson wrote that he did not see this as something that a president should proclaim, because it was still so closely related. He viewed it as a religious practice, and he didn't think that a president should proclaim any particular day that related to any kind of specific sort of religious practice, that should be left to religious leaders. So yeah, you have the first three presidents had very different interpretations of how they were going to proclaim or not proclaim, in Jefferson's case, nationally, the idea of Thanksgiving. And meanwhile, you know, in different individual states, Massachusetts, New York, Connecticut, you know, places in the South, different Thanksgivings would be proclaimed by often the governors. And then when you were having a Thanksgiving, might be in November in Massachusetts, it might be in, you know, December or October in New York or Connecticut. And so it was still very much left to the state authorities to do that, until we get back up to 1863 with Lincoln.
What is her connection? What is Sarah Hale's connection to Abraham Lincoln, and this, you know, this culmination of a quest to get a president to issue the kind of Thanksgiving proclamation that she believes this nation needs? Tell us a little bit about their relationship.
Hale and Lincoln were not personal friends, although I could find no evidence that she ever met him, although it is possible she may have. I could find no evidence that she did. So her daughter's brother-in-law was a General Hunter who was very close with Lincoln. But Hale knew that if she wanted a national day of thanks, the kind of proclamation that Washington initially did, but for the entire United States every year on the same day, she had to get the authorities on her side. And she would write governors individually, trying to get them to all agree on the same day. She wrote ambassadors, she wrote the heads of territories, but she knew she needed to get a president on board. And so she writes Taylor and Pierce and Fillmore and Buchanan. And finally, she writes Abraham Lincoln and his Secretary of State, William Seward. Seward, in his autobiography, you know, he says he went into Lincoln and said, because this is in the middle of the Civil War, you know, they're saying we're trying to take away states' rights. I have another right we can take away from them, the right to name Thanksgiving. Seward had already begun drafting a potential proclamation. He and Lincoln finished it up together. And Lincoln got on board, and that 1863 began the string of annual November Thanksgivings that we are familiar with today. And it was really lovely, and one of my favorite things about these sorts of books is the research, and you read the letter that she wrote to him, and it's so long, and you know, she puts in clippings about, this is what my magazine said about it. Like, she kind of had, like, she had her proof in there too. We've got this many. Ohio's governor has declared it on the same day every year. You know, people are joining my cause and all this sort of stuff. So I hope you will, you know, proclaim it as well. And he did.
So for all the kids who grew up putting on a little pageant with pilgrim hats and really offensive scenarios of gathering together with indigenous people welcoming. Okay, where'd that come from? How did that end up being part of a tradition that somehow made sense to somebody somewhere?
I grew up with all of that too. And I want to be clear that I am far from the first person to bring up the fact that the story a lot of us were told about 1621 and the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag Native Americans, that just isn't how that played out. There had been a number of quote-unquote Thanksgivings proclaimed on the North American continent by various settlers when they came here and were thankful they made it through a winter, this, that, and the other thing. Virginia, in La Florida, as it was called when it was under Spanish rule, Texas, Maine, you know, all over the place. Were the Pilgrims in Plymouth in 1621? Absolutely. Was there a meal that they shared with the Wampanoag? Yes, there was. But it pretty much ends there. There's no historical evidence that the Wampanoag were actually invited. There was no official proclamation or declaration of that as a Thanksgiving, which of course was the custom. You would proclaim Thanksgiving. And of course, beyond that, the relationship between the newcomers and the indigenous peoples on this continent was not one that was certainly not a happily ever after by any reach of the imagination. How does that take hold? Well, it starts in the media. It was a very strong, the idea of Thanksgiving and Thanksgiving meals, you know, where Hale was from in New England, was a very big idea, because so many of the settlers who came to the United States came to the Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut area. But at some point in like the mid to late 19th century, you start to see these romanticized versions of early Thanksgivings. And one or two of them, one was in a magazine called Our Young Folks, and another one was in Ladies Home Journal. And then a woman actually wrote a full-length novel, Standish on Standish, in which she described a fiction, in which she described a meal that there's no way, the things they served, there's no way it could have taken place. And it's exactly the kind of story we were told as kids. And these things start to take root. But what was interesting is when Hale approached Lincoln and all these presidents, she never once set out to commemorate a specific day or event that had nothing to do with it. And in Lincoln's proclamation, he's not saying we're doing this because there was this first Thanksgiving. And, you know, as the 19th century moves on, there was a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment. The idea of first Americans and real Americans, and as opposed to people who were just coming over from these other countries. A lot of people took to that. A lot of these things just kind of dovetailed and gained steam, but definitely the women's magazines and young people's magazines became a part of that. Yeah.
What do you think the role of Thanksgiving in its ideal, if we wanted to hold it up to an ideal, what does it mean to America today?
The holidays changed in so many ways. I think Hale would be, and Lincoln would be scratching their head at, you know, football games and Black Friday sales and things of that nature. But I think one of the things that Hale certainly would be on board with is the Thanksgiving holiday over years has also become associated with charity and donations and Giving Tuesday and things of that nature. At its core is about giving thanks. And I think this year, because we have to pare down and hunker down and not have the kinds of celebrations that we might be used to or want, we have this real opportunity to have a quieter, more purposeful, more kind of intentional holiday in a sense. If you're not obligated to host 20 people, you can intend to communicate with folks maybe you don't always get to talk to over the holiday because you're running around doing all of these other things. So I think there that this year in particular, as hard as it is, and it's hard for all, this is rough this year, it's all the more important to find those things to stop and say thank you for. And the idea that we're all doing it on the same day, I think, is still a very powerful thing. Because, you know, right now, if you've got food on your table and a roof over your head and you don't have a virus, I mean, you've hit the jackpot. You're in pretty good shape.
The 2020 jackpot. The book is called We Gather Together. Denise Kiernan has been my guest. Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, and happy holidays.
South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lori Walsh in a conversation with journalist and author Denise Kiernan. Dakota Date Book is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
In my North Dakota home.
Well, hello there. This is Tom Brusseau. We could all use a little comfort food for the ears right about now, and we've got that for you on the next Great American Folk Show. We'll talk collard greens and black-eyed peas with writers Julie Wolfson and Zoe Howell. She's worked with Sufjan Stevens, introducing the wistful, earthy tones of Brooklyn singer-songwriter Melissa Mary Ahern. We'll hear from cowboy poet and songster Andy Hedges, plus South Carolina Poet Laureate Marcus Amaker, North Dakota Associate Poet Laureate Bonnie Larson Steiger. We've got an auto harp player whose name is Colin Haynes. Writer Gianni Washington reads an original piece of fiction. And Glenn Phillips from Toad the Wet Sprocket returns with the short story When JFK Came to UND. Lots of great people, lots of great voices. Hear them all on the Great American Folk Show, Sunday, December 6th at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 23rd, celebrating 100 years since the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. This series is written and voiced by Sarah Walker.
When the Federal Suffrage Amendment passed in the U.S. House and Senate on June 4, 1919, there were many calls in North Dakota for a special session so North Dakota could ratify the amendment. However, Nonpartisan League Governor Frazier did not want the expense of a special session just for the sake of suffrage. Yet there were teasers that a special session might be called, including reports in the paper that the governor had said as much, which he denied. Finally, Governor Frazier did call a special session to convene on November 25th and specified that the first order of business was ratification of the Suffrage Act. Other matters of interest were outlined. though missing, notably, was anything relating to a question of impeachment charges to be brought against Attorney General William Langner and Secretary of State Thomas Hall, petitions of which were circulating around the state. Nonetheless, upon the announcement of special session, Frazier received a wire from Mrs. Carrie Chapman Catt, who thanked him for taking this step on behalf of all supporters of women's suffrage. This was only the third special session called since North Dakota had become a state, and the second called by Frazier. North Dakota did ratify the suffrage amendment at the special session, becoming the 20th state to do so. North Dakotans also reacted as the matter was debated in North Carolina and Tennessee the following year. The anti-league candidates for state offices in North Dakota issued a telegram expressing their approval for suffrage and urging that the two states vote for the federal amendment. Not to be outdone, the nonpartisan leaguers sent a telegram to Tennessee stating, "The North Dakota legislature, containing the majority of the nonpartisan league farmers in both houses, was among the first to ratify the suffrage amendment. And although they did not desire to be put in the position of seeming to dictate to the legislature of Tennessee, they hoped the state would join their ranks. Tennessee did, becoming the final state needed for ratification." Suffrage had been a struggle, but as James Beauchamp Clark, Speaker of the U.S. House, said, "Suffrage was as inevitable as the rising of tomorrow's sun." This is Sarah Walker.
This series is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota and the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
For a lot of us, the holidays are going to be a bit different this year. Many people will be separated from their loved ones for the first time and will have to rely on things like Zoom and FaceTime. Others are paring down their usual big family gatherings. But whatever the case, people are finding innovative ways to safely spend time together. So, what about you? What's your plan for the holidays? We would love to hear about it. Call us at 701-428-1686 and record your story. And hey, you might even inspire someone else to celebrate creatively this holiday season and spread some much-needed cheer. That number again is 701-428-1686. Call us and tell us your name, where you live, and your holiday plans and ideas, and we'll share them on the air and online. Whatever and however you celebrate, we at Prairie Public wish you a safe, happy, and healthy holiday season.
Hi, well, I see trees of green and red roses too.
Joe Biden won Pennsylvania and the presidential election. What do Pennsylvanians who supported him expect of him now?
My expectation is it's going to be a kinder, friendlier, and more professional presidency.
Pennsylvanians look ahead to the Biden presidency on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
We're glad you could join us today for Main Street, which you can listen to on your radio as we broadcast her online at prairiepublic.org. Tuesday on our show, we'll talk with filmmaker Matt Fearn about his documentary Fighting Over Sue, which tells the story of the controversy over UND's former athletic nickname. Tom Ezern will share a Plainsfolk essay he's titled The Agency of Wheat, and we'll visit with a UND nursing student and talk about her experience as a contact tracer. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.